was supposed to do a pretty much all Knicks-based podcast here with Chris Herring on the Podium Game podcast. Chris from the Wall Street Journal. What's going on, Chris? How you doing?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm doing well. Now, we're going to get to the Knicks stuff in a little bit, but two major injuries came down between the time I booked the podcast and the time you came on, so we'll talk about those for a minute here. LaMarcus Aldridge is going to be out with a torn thumb ligament, something in his thumb, on his non-shooting hand, on his left hand. He's going to be out 6 to 8 weeks, which equates 18 to 24 games. You think they can hold the fort down in the Western Conference and kind of hold off? I mean, you have the Thunder looking to jump in, and everyone else, you have the Thunder with the 8 teams that are in. You confident that they can hold on, or you think there's a reason to be concerned?
Well, it's tough to say. I think they'll probably be fine. I mean, they're not in danger of not making the playoffs, I don't think, or anything like that. But, you know, in a normal situation, you say, man, this really screws with their seeding, and maybe you get a bad matchup because of it. But the way so many of us look at it right now, everybody is going to get a tough matchup in the West anyway, just with the way that the conference is shaping up and how, you know, you could be a one seed and end up playing Oklahoma City, depending on how it shakes out. So there really is no given, depending on where they finish anyway. So it's tough for them. You know, I think it probably wasn't a coincidence that their last game that they shot the most poorly that they've shot all season in a game, they lose to Boston. It'll be tough without him. You know, sometimes I'm not in love with Aldridge as a player. He's a very, very good player. There are nights where he's great. He does do some stuff with their spacing sometimes because of just how effective he is from certain parts of the floor. I think he's improved, and the team as a whole has improved a lot on defense. So, you know, the thing that I've been impressed with from them over the years is that they've stayed relatively healthy. And they've had all their core players around. This year they definitely had all their core players around. So this will be a test for them, but I'm not sure it changes a whole lot about what I think about their chances, just because, you know, he should be back early enough to get really fully back to full speed by the time the playoffs roll around. And I don't think the seeding is going to matter a whole lot in the West anyway. So it's tough for them, but it might strengthen some of the other players on the roster by having him out.
Before he got hurt, they had lost 3 of 4, and the only win was against the Kings, and it was a 4-point win. They lost to Phoenix the first game without him, then they lost a really bad loss to Boston at home last night. The Suns game, they played really poorly and went on a crazy comeback in the second half. They have their next six games: Washington at home, then at Brooklyn, at Cleveland, at Atlanta, at Milwaukee, and Utah at home. If they struggle during that stretch, if, say, they only get 2 wins out of that, I would start to be concerned, because after that, the schedule gets significantly tougher. You have the Thunder, who are starting to click. The Suns have won 14 out of 18. So I think they need to get a good 4 wins against these Eastern Conference teams plus Utah to kind of hold the fort down. So if they struggle once they start playing all these West teams in the next 5 weeks after that, that they have enough of a cushion that they don't have to worry about it.
Obviously you don't want to fall into too much of a tailspin, and it's kind of speculative at this point, just because, you know, on paper they're a very good team even without Aldridge there. I mean, obviously it's a huge loss for them. It's a player that they depend on for, you know, more than 20 points a night. But, you know, Lillard, they've got one of the best wing rotations in the league, especially in their starting five. Their defense has been way better than I expected it to be. I know you and I think have talked about this before. I don't know if we completely agree on it, but, you know, the fact that the makeup of their roster is so similar to what the Knicks had 2 years ago, especially last year. They were statistically, they looked exactly the same as that team, that 54 win Knick team. Really, really great on offense, spread the floor with a lot of 3-point shooting. A player that primarily likes to really operate out of the mid range area, and not that good defensively. You know, like middle of the pack, slightly worse than average on defense. The difference between the Blazers and the Knicks, though, is that the Blazers kept that same offense and then got, you know, have been elite on defense this year. And that was the jump that the Knicks never really made. And so I feel like that gave them a chance. That's why you start hearing them as kind of like fringe championship contenders. And that's where, you know, losing someone like Aldridge, it's hard to imagine them being in that conversation if Aldridge either doesn't return as quickly as they hope, and maybe they fall a little too far out of contention to really be, you know, a top four seed, and, you know, it becomes tough for them because they have to play a Golden State or something. That would be tough. It's tough if Aldridge comes back and he's not back up to speed, he's not 100%. They're going to need everything from everyone because I don't trust him enough yet. You know, if he comes back and he's not himself, it does become tough because you have to assume they're going to struggle a little bit just playing those foes in the West. I think if you just look at them on paper versus the Eastern teams, I think they'd still be better than a lot of these teams, especially Milwaukee's, and some of these teams are still learning how to win despite the fact that they've got talent.
I'd feel better if Lopez was healthy right now.
That's a good point. That's a very good point. Yeah, because it's just the whole front court. You don't want to lose all those guys at once. You don't want to have to overextend some of the guys that have played well on the bench. You look at someone like Kamen. You just don't want to overextend certain guys. You know, everything had worked really well for them with the offseason signings that they had. But they'd had the luxury of everybody being healthy all at once. And when you have to force these guys into duty, you get to see how much they've got left. And, you know, they've gotten comfortable in their roles, and maybe now they're uncomfortable with that. So it'll be interesting to watch, and it'll be a good test for Terry Stotts. He's gotten a lot of credit this year for getting more out of them on defense, but I think this will be the ultimate test for him.
The other guy that went down, now the team isn't really relevant from a playoff perspective or an in-season perspective, but it's still Kobe Bryant. He has a torn rotator cuff. I don't think they've announced he's officially out for the season yet. But you know what's weird? There's like this outrage that he's going to make the All-Star game. I don't get why people get all mad about this in the NBA, but like in Major League Baseball, they sent Derek Jeter the All-Star game for like 8 years in a row when he didn't deserve it. But in basketball, it's kind of frowned upon. I mean, Kobe has 2 seasons left. I see no problem with him getting like the Lifetime Achievement Award nomination for the game and letting fans get to see him maybe his last season.
I don't either. I mean, I've watched Michael Jordan play in his final All-Star games and play well too, quite frankly. I mean, he basically hit what should have been a game winner in one of those final years with the Wizards. There was something fluky that happened where I think, you know, there's no defense played in these games, so I think somebody came back and hit a shot to kind of equalize what he'd just done on the other side. So he didn't get the game winner out of it. But yeah, I mean, these games are supposed to be for fun. The fans vote him in. And to be honest, I mean, it would be interesting. I'll put it this way. If James Harden had gotten voted in over Kobe, it would have been very interesting to see what Steve Kerr had done, whether he would have put Kobe on the roster anyway. I'm not sure he would have. Especially if it would have meant nixing someone like Klay Thompson. There's no way he does that. But, you know, I think as a broadcaster and as a guy that has great respect for players like Kobe and like Michael, I think he would have given it thought. Everyone knows statistically he doesn't deserve to be there, but it's a fan's game. Especially now with this injury, it feels kind of silly yelling and arguing about this because maybe this would have been his last All-Star game. He's been through a lot of injuries the last couple of years. You know, he hasn't. I think this has probably been the clearest indication we've had that he's just not. I mean, he's not healthy enough from year to year anymore to really go out and play the way he likes to play, which is as hard as he can, as many games as he can, you know, with as competitive a team as he can possibly have. And none of those things are really the case anymore. He goes hard and then he's completely ineffective. Byron Scott feels like he has to pull him out of games or, you know, to sit him out. And Kobe doesn't like to play that way. So, you know, on the one hand, yeah, I understand he doesn't deserve to be there statistically. I get why some people are mad. I get why fans of the teams that, you know, kind of get screwed over with the DeMarcus Cousins or, you know, if James Harden doesn't get started, I get why people are upset. But I personally would like to see Kobe play in one last All-Star game just because you know that it's meaningful to him. You know it's meaningful to everybody else. Baseball does a pretty good job getting guys' appearances like those. I get both sides of it because I get that the All-Star game is used as something when you're making Hall of Fame arguments, and, you know, but it's also a popularity contest of sorts, too. And a good example of that, Steph Curry didn't make the game 2 years ago. He absolutely should have, and now he's the leading vote-getter. So stuff can change. I feel like eventually you get your due and your notice anyway. So I'm not someone who really thinks it's that big a deal when people do make it or don't make it. We forget about this and we have the same argument next year anyway.
He's also the guy who makes the game more fun because he'll try way too hard for a short stretch. And Dwayne Wade punched him in the face in the game.
I remember.
Unintentionally.
Was it the broken nose or whatever? Or almost broken? Or
yeah, whatever it was. But
yeah, so I mean, Kobe is that guy that, you know, when his children grow up, till his kid is like 19, Kobe's still going to be trying as hard as he can to beat him and embarrass him, and it's just one of those things where, on some level, you worry because we've all, just like with Jordan, you almost worry that it's too much of a competitive drive. But I like seeing people try way too hard in the All-Star game. I hate the fact that so many people just kind of are nonchalant about it, and that it's like an 180 to 179 game every year. I like seeing the guys try. I like seeing the best players in the world play against the other best players in the world. Is Kobe one of them anymore? No. You know, he obviously has fallen off quite a bit from what we're used to from him. But I like the way that he respects other great players, and I like the way they respect him. And I like seeing those guys go against each other. Because we never did really get to see the LeBron-Kobe finals that so many people wanted to see. So it is fun to watch those guys match up against each other from time to time. Just like it's fun to see Kobe go at Dwayne Wade. Or whoever else. I still enjoy watching it. There's a reason why it's still one of the most marketable names in the sport.
All right, let's keep it miserable. We're gonna start talking about the Knicks now. Just everything's depressing on this podcast. Jesus.
Pretty much.
Yeah, all right. So they're 7-36, but they've won two straight games. Yes, two.
Woo!
Second time this season. The competition was really, really rough also. They beat the 76ers. And who'd they be before that? I looked this up last night. Oh, the Pelicans. But there was no Jrue Holiday or Anthony Davis.
Right.
So they let the two games, the last two, Anthony Davis, the game last year, Anthony Davis got hurt in like the first quarter, but they still lost and they couldn't beat him. This year, they just avoided him completely in the game at MSG.
Yeah, I mean, the Knicks were at some point due to have some sort of good fortune or luck, you know, whether you want to call it luck, that they catch the Pelicans on a day where he's not playing. I mean, I remember looking, and I've tweeted this statistic out a lot. I think that the Knicks had lost, 15 or 16 straight games that had gone down to the last 5 minutes of a five-point game within 5 points one way or the other, and they had lost like 15 or 16 straight games like that. Like that, as bad as the Knicks are and as bad as their coaching and execution was in the final stages of those games, it's really hard to do that. It's pretty unheard of to lose that many games in the same way without winning any of them. And so they were due to have some good luck at some point, the same way the Knicks were last year when their season started, and not nearly as bad as this one, but started really poorly. Tyson Chandler breaks his leg or fractures his leg. You know, at some point they were due to have stuff turn around, whether it's scheduling at some point where the schedule just gets really soft and you have a couple games you can string together. But yeah, I mean, they had something coming down the line. You knew at some point they're going to win a game or two that maybe earlier in the season they would have lost. So maybe it's new energy from the guys they brought in. Obviously Langston Galloway's played well. Maybe it's Lou Amundsen and Lance Thomas, who I've been kind of critical of, and maybe that's not fair. I don't think it has anything to do with them as much as just the situation and maybe the fact that I'd like to see younger guys get those opportunities. But they've actually played pretty well, despite not really knowing the system on offense.
No, Lance Thomas and Amundsen are both better than Quincy Acey.
They might be. I mean, it's one of those things. With Amundsen, I still struggle with that just because he's 32. Like, on some level, I guess you could look at it on the one hand and say, well, he should be better because he's older, he's more experienced, he knows what he's doing. But on the other hand, I mean, he is 32, and a lot of guys, that most journeymen in the league aren't still playing well at that age. At that point, especially when they don't even really know what they're doing because of the fact that they're in an offense where they haven't learned it yet. So I do like what they bring. I'm not sure that I'd say they're better than AC just yet. They've looked okay, and I've actually been pleasantly surprised at how they've looked. But what does bother me about that is even if you think that they are better than AC, AC is 24, which suggests maybe he's got a little bit of room for upside, and he had been playing well up until this point where they just decided to stop playing him altogether, which that's what I don't understand. It really bothers me, the lack of consistency. Like, I know that they're not going to do anything. I know the rotations don't matter quite as much. I don't care about, like, the consistency within the rotations. But to just sit guys completely after AC has, like, a 19-point game and is shooting the ball really well from three-point range, that just, unless they've already made a decision to move on from him after the season is over, which would surprise me a little bit because I think he's shown enough, I don't get why you do this yo-yo thing with the guys that have shown that they're actually not that bad, especially at a relatively young age. AC is the youngest of the three players we were talking about, so I wouldn't understand that, but maybe they know something that I don't know.
I was very strongly against bringing Amundsen and Thomas on 10-day contracts. And now they're on their second one, so they have to be signed for the rest of the season if they decide to bring them back again. I would still let Amundsen go. I'm in on Lance Thomas, though. I've completely changed on him. He's still only 26.
Right.
And he can guard all five positions on the court. He has a length, and he has length, he has good lateral quickness. They gotta teach him how to shoot, though.
Yeah, his shot looks ugly.
But if they could teach him how to shoot, I think he could really bring something. He's not someone I would mind being around next year either. He brings an aspect that this team doesn't currently have, and bringing in a guy who can defend like that could really help them.
I really like, and I think maybe it's because you're seeing some of them on the court at the same time, I really like how many guys they could potentially have with length on this team. I noticed that with Galloway, too. Galloway's got really, really long arms. He's not the tallest guy, but he's got long arms. He moves okay defensively. He moves pretty well at times. He doesn't look like someone that would be overwhelmed if he had to go switch on to someone else that plays a bigger position. But him and Lance on the floor together, and then you combine that with some of the guys that you're expecting to get, mostly Thanasis, and that's something that you see a lot of these good defenses have them. They've got guys that are just long. Milwaukee is probably the best example of that, and they're just really not fun to play against on defense because they've got so many guys between Henson and Giannis, and it's difficult to make what should be easy passes. It becomes more difficult to make against a team that's got length like that. So I do like the fact that Lance Thomas seems to be pretty versatile on the defensive end. They should be looking for as many guys like that as they can possibly find. And that would be a plus, I think, if they're able to hold on to him. I'm not as high on Lou, but it has nothing to do with him and the way he's played because I think he's done well. And I have a lot of sympathy for his situation. I tweeted out a New York Times story earlier. He's been on 10 teams now. He's only the 12th player in NBA history to play for that many teams in a career. And he actually seems like a decent player, but at this point, I wonder whether it would really make sense to bring someone in who's that old. And the funny thing is that, based on the way he's played and how much Fisher likes him, I actually think that they probably are leaning toward keeping him, but I just don't think that there's a point to doing that with his age.
So it sounds like we're on the same page. You'd be okay with signing Lance Thomas for the rest of the season, but you would pass on Lowe.
Yeah, I have no problem with Lance. I like his game enough to where I think it's not a lost cause to bring him back. You know, you're still learning about him. And quite frankly, I mean, he's the same age as Cole. And I think Cole was still in that evaluation period where they're trying to figure out, you know, is he a piece for next year? Is he not? He's 26. He's kind of like right at that breaking point age. You start getting 27, 28. You know, you're not trying to build around those guys that are, you know, still developmental projects. With 26, you know, especially with Lance, I think he's only been on two other teams, maybe one or two other teams before. And so he hasn't really had a lot of chance to learn in a system where he's probably getting time to play. So this is a good opportunity for him. And it's pretty similar to the way I viewed Cole last year, because Cole had kind of bounced around, but had never gotten really substantial playing time anywhere. And really, this is the first year that he has. That's my only issue with bringing in Lou and Lance in the first place, is just that there are so many other guys that you're trying to evaluate that, you know, isn't completely fair to sit certain guys out that have been diligent and have been in the system all year, that have struggled through all the losing, that you went out of your way to trade for or to get, you know, in a trade like AC, and then once they actually do play pretty well, to just sit them completely. I don't like that, but I understand that they're in an evaluation period. They're just trying to see what everybody has. It's a little strange, but I guess I understand it.
So, which brings us to the one guy, if you're a Knicks fan, that you, I think, you need to have a cautious optimism about. You can't go all in on him yet, but you have to like what you've seen, and there's no reason he can't continue to keep growing. As you mentioned before, Langston Galloway. I went and looked at his on-off numbers for the last six games that he's been on the team, and when he's on the bench, they're a negative 26.7 net rating per 100 possessions, and when he's on the court, they're 0.8 positive.
That's weird, yeah. And I actually saw you having a conversation with someone about that on Twitter, trying to kind of figure out why that was. And I haven't even really been able to figure out exactly why that is yet. You know, there are some moments where he's on the court a lot with Melo, and obviously Melo is the best player on the team. But there have also been moments where he hasn't played well, but yet the team has done really well in those moments where he's not playing well, Langston. So it's still hard to tell. I mean, it's still a relatively small sample size, but it's something to pay attention to. I remember saying this when people asked me early on, once they brought him up, what do you think of him? And I said, well, I don't remember having a really strong opinion of him in summer league or in training camp, really. My only thought was that because he didn't stand out one way or the other, he looked like he belonged. He didn't look out of place. And in a lot of cases, we laugh about certain guys, Travis Outlaws and whatnot. I mean, certain guys you know do not belong out there. And I mean, now that we know how bad the Knicks are, when you stood out because of how bad you were on a Knicks training camp team, you know that player really must be terrible. Langston clearly belonged. And, you know, he looked like he was a part of what was going on. And now we see why. He looks like he can really play. He can handle the ball, but he also can play off guard, which I think is useful, especially since, you know, this is a system that just kind of lets guys play and you fill different positions with all the ball movement and whatnot. So I like him. I mean, he doesn't seem to be afraid of the moment at all. He obviously hit a big shot the other night in Philly, and he looks as if he can defend. And that's my biggest thing with this next team that they're going to bring in next year, is that you've just got to have guys that are not complete liabilities at one end of the floor. That for years, I think, has been their biggest issue, is that you never have balanced players. And from what I've seen so far, he looks as if he can at least be balanced. He's a really great rebounder, at least on the offensive side of the ball. He has these tip dunks that are really nice. He's just got a nose for the ball. He's good around the rim. He's aggressive. He's kind of everything you would hope for. You just hope that he you know, that this isn't just a kind of a fluke, or maybe just an early thing where people don't know how to play him defensively. But he looks really solid. So it looks like he'd be a really solid piece going forward.
And he brings some of the skills this team desperately lacks and that they should be looking to add as they go forward. The ability to create off the dribble, seems to have a decent jumper. It's been going in. Sometimes it gets a little flat, It looks like to me. And when he consciously puts a little bit more arc on it, I feel like it goes in at a higher rate. I don't have any way to justify that thought, and I could be just making things up, but from what I've watched, that's something that I've seen. He's good next to Calderon because he has the ability to guard both positions and create with the dribble, as I just talked about. What I've seen the last two games, this is the first time that you kind of see and even though I don't like Amundsen on this roster, despite I think that he's a role player in the NBA, with him and Thomas playing next to Melo with Galloway, and you're playing Jason Smith and Romari at center, it's the first time this season that you kind of conceptually go, okay, these lineups kind of make sense, and you can kind of see where this is going in the future, if this is what their idea of how to build a team is. You have a versatile wing who can guard the 3 and 4, next to Melo. You have a guard who can create off the bounce and guard both positions next to Calderon. And to kind of help with that spacing, if you have a guy who can't shoot next to Melo at the other forward, you have a Jason Smith or an Amari who are at least a threat from the mid-range, so it doesn't completely muck up your spacing. And you're like, all right, this actually makes sense. And I think, for me, it's important for Fisher to actually carry this out for at least give me like a week of this before playing around and start another thing so I can gain some confidence in it. He sees something that works. Now let's stick with it and see how it does for a little bit instead of constantly changing, changing, and changing.
You know, that's an interesting point because normally I think what was so frustrating about Mike Woodson was that a lot of times he would change lineups and they were winning. And you were like, well, what are you changing lineups where you're having success with that? Especially, you know, the one that all of us went kind of crazy over was the fact that him and he would always switch up the lineups, even though Ray and Pablo were like 15-1 together. Because I remember there was actually one game where Pablo started that they lost, but Ray wasn't in the starting lineup in it. So they were 15-1 at the end of that 2012-13 season, which I think was the best record ever for two players in a starting backcourt together, you know, 15 games or more. And then the next year, he wasn't sold on that lineup. So he started that lineup the first game of the year and then changed it the very next game, even though they'd won. Because he's like, oh, I just want to, you know, I want to experiment with this big lineup. And then he played the big lineup they lost. And it was weird because, like, well, you've already seen something that worked and you're going away from it. With Fisher, I guess I've been tough on him with his rotations and the fact that he's kind of inconsistent with them. But I guess to kind of stick up for him on the other side of the dime, he at least they're losing, and so he's changing the lineups to try to see if he can find something that helps them win. The only problem with that, like you said, is that they have certain lineups that can work. It might not be their starting lineup, but you might have lineups that work for like a good 5 to 10 minutes. In the middle of the second quarter. And those are the things that, you know, the assistants, that the scout people, that Fisher himself, when he goes back and looks at film, has to look at and say, wow, this is working. We have to try this more. And they've had a couple lineups that have worked like that. And to your point about just these five guys specifically and kind of this just this look, having Calderon along with someone that can create, having Melo along with someone that can defend either wing position, and then just having a center who can shoot a mid-range shot, that ideally is what they're going to look like next year. You know, they're going to need someone clearly, regardless of whether Melo's at the three or the four. They're clearly going to need a better wing defender than what they've had. They're clearly going to need someone that can get into the paint to get them the foul line more. They're clearly going to need a center that can shoot a little bit and, you know, hopefully post up better than what we've seen from D'Alembert and other guys this year. So, yeah, on some level, conceptually, this is exactly what they're going to look like. And maybe it is useful for them to kind of experiment with this more just to get a sense. You don't assume that Langston Galloway would be their starting point guard next year or shooting guard or whatever. But even if he's not, you need someone that kind of is doing the sorts of things he does just to get the most out of the triangle and to make it a more efficient offense where they're not living and dying off mid-range shots but also getting to the line and taking threes.
And then if you find, like, Galloway and Thomas – not Galloway, Thomas and Amundsen can't shoot – so you need to have shooting from the center position. If you have a wing that's maybe a little more offensively adept, then you don't. It's not necessarily as much needed to have that shooting at center. So, I mean, it's just how all the pieces fit together. So it could be a little adjusted going forward and not exactly how it is now. But when you're playing Amundsen and Thomas and you have a non-shooting person at the three, you want to have shooting at all those other four positions. You basically, for me, I only want one person that can't shoot on the court at all times, pretty much. That's my limit.
You have to even have that. But yeah, I understand what you mean. That there have been times where you look out there and you're just like, sheesh. And it's funny because they're not as bad in that respect as what I was thinking they might be, because at the beginning of the season, I thought AC really couldn't shoot. And, I mean, his shot doesn't look great, but he's also knocked it down at a pretty decent rate. You know, the irony is that so many of these other guys, you've expected to be great shooters, have really struggled. You know, Calderon, statistically, he's not that bad from three, but, you know, he hasn't been that great from mid-range. He's been a little bit more hesitant than what I thought he would be in terms of pulling the trigger on his jump shot. And just a bunch of other guys that, you know, probably aren't meant to be shooting. Obviously, D'Alembert for the majority of the season was like that. So, yeah, but ideally in no offense do you have more than one guy that can't shoot. Or if you're going to do that, it's because they're such great defenders that they make up for the fact that they can't shoot with their defense. And clearly, the Knicks don't have any defenders on their team like that. I think at one point you could have argued that Shumpert was that good. But his defense had slipped so much this year that, you know, you can't afford to have guys out there that basically don't defend and can't shoot. And they've gotten into trouble with that, obviously, with Hardaway, with the kind of slumps he's had over the course of the season as well.
Now, people, with where they are, there's people that want to see Theonis called up. I have my opinion on this. Let me hear, do you think they're considering that, or do you think they're going to hold off till next season?
I think they're probably at a point where they've decided to move on. I could be wrong about that. Nobody's really asked Phil, and obviously he knows, you know, Fisher is really mom and tight-lipped about that sort of thing. I mean, I think I know your theory on this. I think we've kind of tweeted about it before, but there's a part of me that wouldn't mind seeing him come up, but I do think that, you know, they might just be thinking about it conceptually and saying, well, where we're at right now, he's not helping us. We don't need him to help us win. He's actually the kind of player that, based on what they struggle with, could help them win. They might not want that number one right now just because of trying to get a better draft pick. And number two, the atmosphere within the team right now is so kind of wishy-washy with moving guys in and out with 10-day contracts and Fisher playing some guys some nights and not playing guys other nights, and the roster changing here and there, that you might not want someone in a position where they're dealing with all that change and, like, no consistency at all. So I could kind of see them just waiting, you know, for contract purposes to bring him over until next year. But I wouldn't, you know, if they were to bring him over, I'm sure it would be somewhat exciting for the fans. But you don't want him to be so overwhelmed when he comes over either that it ruins him. I don't think that could really happen, but maybe there's an outside shot that if they're just not consistent at all and if the roster is going to change a whole lot more from now, you don't want to bring him in with a bunch of guys that haven't been on the team and he doesn't even have a chance to really get settled with. So we'll see. I could see it from either side, though. What do you think?
Here's where I'm at with it. If you could get him to sign a 4-year contract like the Rockets did with Chandler Parsons, I'm okay with wasting one of the cheap years this season to get him 30-some-odd games of NBA experience. If he's only willing to sign like a KJ McDaniels deal and he's betting on himself or what Cle'Anthony Early did for 2 years, then I'm not wasting the cheap year. That's where I'm at with that.
Yeah, it always comes down to that. I mean, I understand why you wouldn't want to do that. I mean, the other thing is that you might not want to really figure out the whole contract thing right now anyway. If you do have to commit to multiple years, mainly because they're going to be in a situation this summer where they might need every dime, depending on what approach they take. And so I definitely understand. I mean, they'll have a clearer sense about all that stuff come July. But, you know, he might be better served right now learning and playing 30, 35 minutes in the D League as opposed to coming up now. I mean, we've said that Cle'Anthony Early should be doing that for this team, and he really still hasn't. Granted, he's got the ankle now that he's dealing with. But even, you know, that London game kind of agitated me, and I know I tweeted about it, because he's the kind of guy right now that should be playing 25, 30 minutes a night. They're not playing for much. You're basically in a learning phase anyway. That's why I thought it was silly to give these guys 10-day contracts at that point. You could have done that after London was over and just given Cle'Anthony Early a long stint of playing time that night. He really hasn't had many games like that, despite how bad they've been because of his because of the knee that he had scoped a couple weeks ago. So I just want to see anybody that they're bringing up for those sorts of purposes, make sure you have minutes for him. I don't think it's worthwhile to have him play for 15 minutes a game instead of him playing 35 minutes a game at the D League level. I'd prefer to just let him learn, unless you're really, really committed to just letting him play and letting him learn once he gets up to the pro level.
Now, before we move on from the young guys, I've been critical of Fisher and Phil Jackson for some things they've done this year. No, I'm not calling for them to get fired or anything ridiculous like that, but I think they've done some wrong. But from the GM perspective with Phil and whatever he has with Clarence Gaines and whoever else is involved with some of the young players they're adding, the one thing that's very encouraging is with whether Theanis, Early, Galloway, Lance Thomas, we're seeing them put an emphasis on guys that can play defense, long and athletic. And even that Nick team that was good in 12-13, I don't know if it really had all of those characteristics, and it's really good to see them focus on that in some of the young talent they're adding, and that's good going forward.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to see. I mean, it's different for Phil. I mean, he's never been an executive. It takes time to figure out. I mean, it probably took him a few more games than the rest of us, too, to really accept that this was just a really, really terrible shipwreck of a team. I mean, Phil coached for 20 years. He never once had a team that didn't make the playoffs. So, the more I really stop to think about his preseason comments about the fact, you know, I think this is a playoff team, he probably meant what he was saying. I don't think he was just trying to say it to hype up the fan base. He probably meant that. I do get the impression that him and Fisher are both a little, maybe arrogant is too strong of a word, but I do get the fact that, you know, I get the impression that they're both really confident, maybe a little overly confident, maybe a little arrogant. Fisher came in touting the fact that, you know, this team last year lost 15 games by 5 points or less. I think Fisher probably tied that within the first month and a half of the season. But, you know, I felt as if he was kind of saying that. I don't think he was intentionally taking a shot at Mike Woodson, but he was saying, you know, hopefully better execution, maybe better coaching in late-game situations will win the sorts of games that they lost last year. So I think that they were really going for it. They really knew the landscape of the East. They thought that the East was going to be more leveled out this year and that it might give them a better shot. And it just backfired. So it's good to see them acknowledging that now and to try something different, to go younger. I'm not completely convinced they know exactly how to go younger if they end up signing Amundsen long-term. Like I said, he's played well, but, you know, based on the goals of what they're trying to accomplish now and what they've said is the primary goal, you've got to start investing more in guys that are 23, 24, and try to figure out, really weed in and weed out guys that are going to be part of this and guys that are not. And so I think they're getting used to that process now, and it'll be interesting to see this time next year who is still on the roster and how they made a decision to keep those guys.
Do you have any clue what's wrong with Melo's knee?
He's made it sound like, so the way he described it was that he, almost as if he had something loose, he said like kind of like a marble or something that he said in his knee that just kind of like rolls around or sloshes around. It sounds as if there's maybe like loose cartilage or something like that, which, you know, doesn't sound good, might sound slightly painful. But the way he's handled it so far, the fact that he can take 2 weeks off and then almost look good as new with the way he's played, in some of these games, he obviously didn't look very good against Philly. I think it was 8 of 24. But it seems as if, you know, and I don't want to downplay it, I'm sure it's painful to play through at times. I'm sure it's not comfortable. But the fact that he seems selective about when he's going to play. And the fact that he's doing that, if this were a season where the Knicks were in playoff contention, I don't think he'd be sitting out at all. I think it's more because they are so far out of the race. Look, it doesn't really make sense to play here tonight. If his knee isn't feeling 100%, I think he would play through that situation more often than not if the team was in contention, if they were fighting for something. But, I mean, you know, I do think it's serious enough to where he's going to need surgery, but I do, for whatever reason, you know, he said it can't get worse. I don't know if I believe that it can't get worse, but I do think that he's able to play on it for what it's worth and that, like, without really losing that much. When they play the 4 games in 5 nights, I'm sure that's when it's tough for him. But when he's getting these long breaks and he looks fine, where he's still got bounce in his step offensively, defensively hasn't looked good at all, but I don't know how much of that to attribute to the knee. But I honestly think he's okay, and that it's just one of those questions where how much longer is he going to play, because it's really not worth it And I do think at some point that will happen, you know, shortly after the All-Star break. We'll see, because he has never come out right out and said that, but it would be a bit curious and a bit odd if he continued to play based on the way he's talked about the knee. But I do think he's looked okay enough to keep playing on it.
Can't they just be a little bit smarter? Like, I'd prefer them shut him down right now, obviously. But if you're going to play him, can't they be smarter about it? Like,
nothing less.
Yeah, like, play him 25, 28 minutes. And, what you're doing with Amari, who's not going to be here, or he better not freaking be here after this season, I swear to God. Why not treat Melo with more care, considering he's on a 5-year contract for a boat ton of money? It seems like they're doing this backwards.
They don't have it'll sound rude. It doesn't seem like they have the balls to tell him to just stop playing. There have been suggestions, Phil has said that this is a decision he has to make for himself. Why?
But what about
he doesn't write checks for you, you write checks for him. Like, I would think that you could tell him, no, you're done at this point. Or, maybe they don't want to telegraph it, because then I'd feel like it would put him in an ugly-looking position if they come right out and say he's going to play until the All-Star game and then sit out. That would look bad, and I don't know if you can call that selfish, because I think most people would want to do that. If you play in front of the New York fans every night, you play at the Garden every home game, you probably do want to play in the All-Star game that's being played at MSG. So I understand why that's important to him. I hope it's not the only reason he's continuing to play. He also sounds as if he really doesn't want to leave his teammates out to dry, because they are so terrible without him out there. So we'll see. I mean, we'll obviously get a really clear-cut answer after the All-Star break and how long he continues to play after that. But, I don't think the team has enough gall to just tell him, look, you're done. You're not playing anymore. There's no purpose in you playing anymore. Their games are sold out, and even if they weren't, that wouldn't be a good reason to tell him, look, you should still play so that we can fill the seats. I think most of the games are sold out anyway. They're not going to win enough, either way to get in the playoffs. The playoffs shouldn't be a goal at this point anyway. And Melo, him being out there, actually, to some extent, if they win too much, it actually hurt their objective at this point, which is to get one of the top picks in the draft. So I just don't understand the point in him playing, but the more you talk to Fisher and the more you talk to Phil, they make it sound as if they've suggested to him that he sit out more than he has, but he doesn't, Melo doesn't want to, and they're like, well, we have to make him a part of the decision too. You're not really making him a part of it, though. You're letting him make the decision. If you're telling him, we think you should sit out, and he's saying, no, I want to keep playing. So hopefully there reaches a point where he just realizes that it's not worth it anymore. But, I could make the argument that that point was a month ago.
All right, so with dumping J.R. Smith and Shumpert, it seems pretty clear that this team's plan right now is just to use their available cap space, which it sounds like it's going to be in the mid to low 30s, unless they're also able to move Calderon, in which case it'd go to the high 30s, maybe even around 40, depending where the cap falls after this season. What I want them to do right now is, I want them to try and, instead of just doing this, we're going to use all our cap space and spend it and try and build this thing quick. I would like them to use Bargnani's contract as a vehicle to try and get an extra asset by taking on a contract back and getting something attached to it.
So just a player that you think is more of a long-term piece, you think that they could get now?
Someone that's completely useless, but I can get a draft pick attached to it, or a young player that's really cheap. So, like, these are the ideas I came up. I came up with some ideas. I'll give them to you. The Nuggets take on the extra year of JaVale McGee's contract, get Gary Harris attached to it, or one of their picks, preferably both. And then you can either buy out JaVale McGee, or you have him around for one extra season.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
Huh.
And you still, but here's the thing, you still... you're not getting rid of all your flexibility. Even if you do that, McGee only
Yeah, I understand that. I mean, Gary Harris, I think, could turn out to be a really good player. But my question is, would Denver give up Gary Harris to get rid of JaVale? I guess I haven't really paid enough attention to how badly that project has gone for them. And whether they're just looking to get rid of him so badly that they would give up one of their... Because Harris went in the first round, didn't he? Like,
yes.
So would they give up a first-rounder to do that? Like, the way I viewed it is more likely than not, the Knicks would have to get rid of a future pick of theirs to get rid of Bargnani just to get him off the books. Which, in that case, it doesn't really make that much sense to do, mainly because they're in a situation where they could just let him expire, and they don't have to do something with it. I know that's what you're saying. You'd prefer they not do that.
No, because you're saving Denver money. Like, how you think about how what happened with the Shumpert and J.R. Smith, or when the Knicks made the trade with McGrady, you gave up assets for the ability to save money. So you target a team that's looking for cap space.
Are they that ready to give up? Or to just get rid of McGee, they'd give up Harris, though? Right? Like, that'd be a tough... I mean, they're kind of a mess. I'll put it this way. Denver's a bit of a mess. Obviously, Ty Lawson, they, I think, got arrested for a DUI or something like that. They're a mess. Nobody knows how long... not Byron Scott. How long that... why am I blanking on his name all of a sudden? No one knows how long the coaching situation will hold up there. So... maybe they're in such disarray that they would give up Harris. If they do that, I would be willing to at least consider taking on JaVale. Because, I mean, he's actually good at some things. He's really aloof, and he's not the ideal person I think of when I think about the triangle and the smarts that you want these guys to have. But, like you said, it's only a year. He actually has length that we were talking about that's useful in defense. And Harris might be a really good piece for a long time. He could be. So, I mean, I would consider that, but I don't know. I guess it depends. You have to find teams that are really desperate to get rid of guys. And, I mean, I guess the Knicks were obviously in that situation. But I think it's more likely, especially with the way Phil has talked a lot about the idea of not, don't be surprised by anything we do, but that he's going to really carefully guard the team's future. And by that, he means their cap space. I doubt that he would take on a JaVale McGee type, even if it meant that they were getting Gary Harris back, just because I think he's trying to avoid... I mean, JaVale's not necessarily a bad person off the court, but I think he's trying to avoid players like that, that just kind of have this reputation where they're kind of aloof or not all the way there, or that they just, you know, it's not even a character thing as much as it's just a smarts sort of thing. And I think he's trying to avoid those sorts of players. But, I mean, it's worth asking about. And I hope the Knicks are at least thinking about taking back players that could fit their system. I know I tweeted about that a couple days ago, that I don't want to see them just rely completely on the summer. If they can make a trade to get somebody now who they wouldn't have to, they could either get accustomed to their system now and kind of get a head start on recruiting someone that will be a free agent this summer, because they're going to be in a situation where, depending on how many wins they come up with, I don't think people are going to be jumping at the chance to come play in New York. I mean, the system has not gotten rave reviews this first year. It's unknown still what draft pick they'll get, where that draft pick will be. Melo's knee has become an issue, obviously. So if you can get a head start on recruiting someone by having them on your team now, that's not something that I would mind at all. I'd actually like to see them take a shot and do that. Or just pick up someone, you know, Nate Robinson's not an example of someone that I think would be a great fit for what they're doing. But, you know, there are all sorts of players that are out there. You know, I would have loved to have seen them gone after Nate Walters before we knew exactly what Langston Galloway was going to be. But there's some decent players out there just on the wires that nobody's taken yet.
I want to be clear about something. It's not about trading for JaVale McGee. I actually would consider buying him out and using his roster spot on a non-salary player. It's simply about using his extra year as a vehicle to get a long-term young piece. And they have a couple protected draft picks. They own like 3 draft picks in the next 2 years or something like that. And using that to be able to get something that can be long-term helpful. It's not about getting JaVale McGee.
No, trust me, I understood that, but I just wonder, with the way Phil has talked about the game, we've asked him about that a number of times, would you take on someone in terms of a trade where you're actually getting someone back as you're tearing the team down? Would you take on a bigger deal if it meant that you were getting someone you liked? And so in this case, I understood exactly what you're saying. The player that Phil would like in that case would be Gary Harris. It would not be JaVale McGee.
Or a draft pick. You could take one of their draft picks, too.
Right.
They have a bunch
and
of those.
Phil basically said that he wouldn't rule anything out, but he said, I'm going to be very careful with the cash base. So, I mean, obviously, yeah, you could buy out JaVale. But what I'm saying is that I don't know that Phil, because I don't know offhand, but what is it like? He had, was it a $44 million deal he got, or am I mixing him up with someone else?
He has 1 year left on his contract after this season.
And what kind of money is it for, though? Is
give me a second. I have all.
Is it 11, or am I just making that up?
It's somewhere in that range.
That's all I'm saying is that I don't know that Phil wants to commit, even though it's not someone he necessarily would keep on the roster. I don't know that he wants to commit that much. If you stretch that money, and I don't know how it worked exactly with the stretch provision, or if it has to be more years left on the deal before you could do that, I'm not sure he could. But if you did that, I mean, all of a sudden, that doesn't really look that bad at all. And if there's a player that you really like a Harris or a draft pick that you get that you think you can make more use of, then maybe it's worth that. That's actually a way of buying a pick as opposed to doing it the traditional way. So Maybe they could, but I'm not completely sure that Phil will do that. The way he's talked about it, I don't think that the way he's sounded more frequently than not is that he would do that to get an established player that he liked, whereas Gary Harris is still really young, and a draft pick is still a bit of an unknown as to who they would get with it. So I'm not completely sure Phil would do that. That's the way I was answering the way I was. I understand it wouldn't be to get JaVale McGee as the primary piece back, but I'm not sure that Phil, to get a younger asset or a player that he feels like he could build around, would trade to take on a deal like JaVale McGee's deal, because I think that might be a little bit too much money for him to swallow just to get a younger piece.
It is $11 million. And the teams I'd be looking at to do something like this, I mean, the Pelicans have Eric Gordon's contract that you could do that with.
Mm-hmm.
The Kings have a couple guys you could take, and I feel like Sacramento has this delusional feel about where they are and how close they are that they might think that freeing up cap space and using Cousins as like your attraction point, that you have two guys like Carl Landry who deal runs for 2 years after the season, and Jason Thompson who also runs for 2 years after the season, but individually their contracts aren't that ridiculous, and they could also probably be moved once you got a hold of them in some other fashion,
mm-hmm.
that you might be able to get something decent out of Sacramento if you gave them that cap space going forward to open stuff up for them.
That's the key to all this. I mean, we haven't said it, but I mean, the key is finding a team that
you got to find desperate.
Has operated like the Knicks have operated,
yes,
the last few years, where they basically are so itchy to get rid of something that they will give up something that you should not give up on, and that's exactly what you're kind of alluding to. And teams that feel like they're kind of like the objects are closer than they may appear in the window. Teams that think they're closer to contending than they actually are, and because of that, really want to get rid of certain people, and in doing that, they get rid of their future. And the Knicks really would, so on that level, I agree with you that the Knicks really should be looking to get some more youth on this team, because the thing is, they've got a lot of young players right now, but we're all kind of on the fence about every single one of them. Nobody stood out so much, you know, with the exception of Galloway over this last week, where you're like, that's absolutely someone they have to have back next year. AC's looked good at times, Cole has looked good at times, but, you know, Hardaway has had his moments more in the first year than the second year. But nobody is like a must-keep, must-have sort of player just yet. And, you know, the Knicks have so few draft picks coming up, thanks to the Andrea Bargnani deal that we all love so much. They really need draft picks and or young players to kind of build a foundation on. And, you know, they're going to need something, and it's not even clear as to who they're keeping right now. So if you can find teams out there, you know, people have asked me about the Knicks-Stauskas deal. He's obviously different because the Kings are looking to get rid of him as opposed to really attaching him with something. I don't think he would be a perfect fit just because I think he and Tim, if Tim is going to be around, he and Tim have too many of the same flaws. But you know, that's what I was getting at, is I think there are enough young players out there, some of whom probably have just been waived altogether, and the D-League showcase just took place. There have got to be people out there that the Knicks like, and, you know, Clarence Gaines is out there kind of scouring what's left, and there have got to be some players out there, and this is why I'm kind of against the idea of signing Amundsen long-term, is because this is who you want to leave space for, just in case you find people or you're able to make a deal with someone. These are exactly the players you'd want to go out and get.
Yeah, so the team, you got the three Western Conference teams that come to mind for me that maybe think they're closer than they are: the Timberwolves, the Kings, and the Pelicans are the three that I think maybe you could see making some sort of panic trade. Who, obviously, the Timberwolves not for this year, but, I mean, they traded a first-round pick for Thaddeus Young. They had no business. They weren't... That's not something they should have done. The Kings have made very clear that their goal is to make the playoffs in the very near future. The Nuggets have kind of had that same idea. The Pelicans have very clearly given up future for now. So those are the type of teams I'd be looking to target for some sort of transaction like this.
Yeah, I mean, they're out there. And it's funny because they've all kind of telegraphed the fact that that's how they feel. I still have such a difficult time trying to comprehend what the hell the Kings are doing between the Mike Malone firing and the, just every time their owner opens his mouth or his ideas, you literally, I feel like I'm looking at a picture of him seeing thought bubbles emanate from his head about 4-on-5, and I'm just like, what the hell is he talking about? But, I mean, if you find a team that is that desperate to show that they are serious about winning right now, when it's clear to the rest of the world that they're not about to win right now, you've got to take it. You know, if you see a player you really like, that's what I was saying a couple of days ago on Twitter, is that I don't want the Knicks to just sit idly by. I don't want them to just be in sell mode without getting anything back. You know, I thought they could have gotten something more back than a second round pick 4 years from now. Those are the sorts of deals that scare me, you know, for Shumpert and JR. Because Phil is old. Phil is not a Sam Hinkie, you know, he's not a young executive. We don't know how long he and Fish are going to be around. You don't want to see them put stuff off so far into the future to where it might not even be useful for this regime, depending on how things go. So I'd like to see them do stuff quicker and sooner rather than later, to get a sense of whether they know what they're doing through the draft and whether they can pick up good players. Because if they can't, then you know they need to be more reliant on some of the cap space they have. But you've got to basically see how well they can evaluate young talent. And, you know, to their credit, Langston Galloway looks like he's a decent player. He went undrafted. Clarence Gaines is someone that kind of found the guy, and he's done well. And if that's going to be his track record, if that's kind of an indication of the sorts of young players they're going to go out and find, or that they can find at the bottom of a scrap heap that another team is not playing, then you want the Knicks to be making deals to find players like that so that they can start building the roster and kind of have a youth movement.
And the key to all this is Bargnani only makes $11 million, so you can only take $11 million in salary back. You're keeping flexibility while also adding to your core. That's where it's okay. Where the problem is, what they've done in the past is when they've made trades for, hey, we're getting rid of this short-term contract and we're adding on longer money, what it was is it was pushing them over the salary cap and taking away their flexibility. What I want to do is I want to add pieces while keeping flexibility. It's just being a little bit more creative than trying to do everything through free agency.
It's kind of I see both sides of that, because to you, what you're saying with flexibility is, like you said, to not be capped out is flexibility. Well,
they'll still have $20 million. I mean, they could still, even if they did something like this, they could potentially still sign a max free agent.
Right, but I think what Phil is starting to kind of wise up to is the fact that they, A, probably won't get a max guy, and B, it seems like he kind of wants to spread the money. I don't know if he wants to spend every dime of it. So yeah, that's what I was saying, though, is that it seems clear to me, for better or worse, they want every single dime they can possibly have going into free agency, which I don't think they need to. And so on that part, I agree with you that, you know, if they did see something they really liked, even though they'd have to take back money from whoever they got in the Bargnani deal. They clearly, I mean, and this is why I'm answering the way I'm answering, they clearly want every dime they could possibly have. They didn't pick up Larkin's option, which doesn't look bad anymore because Galloway looks like he might be a player.
No, but I if I'm projecting forward, I'd much rather have Galloway than Larkin.
Right. I mean, he's some of the issues you have with Larkin and his size you just don't have with Galloway, and he's more aggressive than Larkin. He can finish better than Larkin, and he defends better than Larkin. So I don't have a problem with that anymore, the fact that they probably made the right call there. But that was a call they made out of the fact that they didn't want to have money on the books. And that was only for $1.5 million. And so if they're looking to cut corners that aggressively, but the fact that they won't even pick up an option on a young player who probably still has a little bit of upside, but also would have been relatively easy to trade, and they didn't want to take a chance on $1.5 million. That's why I'm saying if I'm Phil, I don't think if I could get into Phil's head, I don't think he's of the opinion that they would take someone who's worth $11 million, even if they were just to buy him out. If it cut into their cap space that significantly, from $30 or $32 million to $20 million or whatever they'll have after taking on another deal of Bargnani's size, I don't think that Phil wants to do that. Even if it means getting a younger player that he actually really likes back. I just think that he wants youth, but he also clearly wants to see what he can do with this cap space. And again, that's where I think that they are really confident, probably overly confident, in what all they can accomplish through free agency. All
right, you can see Chris's stuff at WSJ.com. You got anything you want to plug?
No. I wrote something earlier today, kind of something I've been working on for the last few weeks, on Pablo Prigioni, kind of how I think he obviously is not a stat-stuffing player. He's 37 years old, but kind of how, just between his hustle and kind of wondering on some level what kind of player would he have been had he come into the league 10 years earlier for the Knicks, and kind of the pick-and-roll Euro style that he plays, but also why I think it's important that the Knicks find somebody with those attributes who, you know, quite frankly, just makes Melo a better, more lethal player, and how he's kind of the perfect complementary player to someone like Melo. And so just wrote on that, and so that's out there, and so hopefully people see it and get a chance to read it.
I like that you said no, you didn't want to plug it, then went on a nice little 30-second rant on what it was about.
I didn't have anything upcoming. That one's already out there. No, I don't have anything except this one piece that I'm going to talk about.
All right, Chris, always appreciate it. We'll do it again sometime in the near future.
Sounds great. Thank you so much for having me, as always.
All right, that wraps up another edition of the Podium Game Podcast.